Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Markowitz. We are your hosts for this weekend edition. On this weekend show, we're going to spend majority of the show with one of my favorite guests, Peter Buchvar, Chief Investment Officer at Bleakley Advisory Group, also editor of the Book Report. I will post a link to Peter's site, that Book Report site, where you can keep up to date with Peter's comments on economic data, market moves, and any key news that he thinks is very market noteworthy and very market moving. Peter, I want to start off really big picture here with 2022 being a very different year for markets. U.S. markets have trended lower pretty much all this year. We've seen a rush into commodities. That was even happening last year, but seems to be a more defensive strategy this year. We have the Fed there, well, starting to hike rates now. There's just so much going on this year that I think people get bogged down with all of this information, all of the news. In your eyes, what's the most important thing that you've noticed this year that really shows the difference that we're seeing in markets and in investors' mentalities?
Well, I think it's the very sharp move in interest rates in a very short period of time. And the delay of the Fed to respond to rising inflation over the last couple of years, it just ran them over. And now that they finally have come around to the need to raise interest rates more notably than they probably wanted to, the move in, call it the U.S. two-year yield, and to use that as a sort of a Fed proxy in terms of pricing in those short-term interest rate increases. The two-year just a year ago, was 15 basis points. Today, it's almost 215 basis points. At the beginning of the year, it was 73 basis points. We've almost tripled in that yield in just under 3 months. So that, to me, is quite unbelievable. And then you can throw in, of course, the decline in the number and the dollar amount of negative yielding bonds, which, speaking of 1 year ago, was something north of $14 trillion. And today, or as of yesterday's close, that pile is actually down to just $3 trillion, which is the lowest level since late 2015. So that shift in response to inflation, in response to central banks both being late and then finally coming around to this, I think is what is most noteworthy. Of course, putting aside the war, I mean, that's the most tragic, of course, but that, to me, just accelerates trends that have already been in place, and that's the rallying commodity prices and a shift to continue persistent inflation. And I think from here going forward, the question is how does the global economy respond both to this spike in energy and food prices and other things post-war, and how does the global economy respond to this move in interest rates? Well, because at least the U.S. economy is obviously very dependent on low interest rates, and with housing and autos being key parts of the economy and obviously the most directly impacted by changes in interest rates, what is the response there? You would have to believe that things are going to start to slow, if not already. And that's what is to come in this macro world.
Well, Peter, that's a great point to think about, is that the growth is slowing, but the interest rates are rising, and that could impact consumers. It could change the profitability of businesses. But you also have this Fed rate hiking cycle starting, as you pointed out, so far behind the curve, with CPI rates at 7.9% and the Fed first rate hike only being at 25 basis points. It's not really going to tame inflation at that point. So we have this kind of stagflationary backdrop with rising inflation, rising energy prices, rising wages, slowing growth. Is it possible they're getting ready to create a kind of a big error by having waited so long? And are we getting near that tipping point where it could go from a stagflationary environment to almost a recessionary environment, maybe a year out or so?
Well, the mistake has already been made by waiting as long as they have. So that's in the books. It's just a question of how compounded does that mistake get? And that will obviously depend on many things, but it will get compounded because the rate hikes will obviously slow the demand side of the economy, particularly housing and autos. Shrinking their balance sheet will have a direct impact on financial conditions and asset prices. And we're already seeing the impact of this changed market landscape. There was an article in the Financial Times yesterday that talked about some of the capital market responses to this changed interest rate landscape and adjustment in equity valuations. There were no IPOs between mid-February and mid-March, according to Dealogic. And the FT said that outside of a holiday period, it marked the longest period without one since 2017. They also talked about equity sales, whether it's secondaries and just generally, has fallen almost 90% from where it was a year ago. Junk bond sales are down 70% from where they were a year ago. So the capital markets response has started. Now we just have to see to what extent is the Fed going to tolerate the tightening of conditions and slowing of the economy. Now, they're purposely trying to do that in order to quell inflation. The question is how much will be needed to do that and how much are they willing to tolerate? In other words, the trade-off between slower growth and shrinking inflation, where's that line going to be? We don't know the answer yet.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? We don't know the answer, but I think everybody does, for the most part, see the writing on the wall where when we do have a tightening Fed and quite frankly, kind of that reopening boost trade that is now starting to dissipate because consumers are quite frankly just running out of cash. What is that breaking point? Question is though, Peter, do you think any economies or markets can withstand this trend that really is globally of higher rates?
Well, those that are least indebted can handle it. The problem is that I don't know of any, relatively speaking. There are some, but in the aggregate, everyone is obviously taking advantage of very low interest rates and have taken on a lot of debt. So that makes us very sensitive to even modest changes in interest rates, because you'll always hear someone say, oh, yeah, but rates are still so low. Well, they are historically speaking, but like I said, small changes in interest rates, when they're so low and debt is so high and we become so dependent on credit to drive economic growth, small changes have an impact. I mean, you look at the U.S. mortgage applications came out yesterday. So for the weekend, I think last Friday, refis in 1 week were down almost 15% in 1 week, week over week, because of the leg higher in interest rates. Now, obviously, that makes a lot of sense for the consumers to respond like that, but to see, you know, such a sharp drop, and they're down like 54% year over year. That's, of course, because so many people have refied in 2020 and 2021 that you run out of people, but they're certainly disincentivized when rates rise. But that, again, that is to come in terms of its broader impact. You know, there's a big debate now in the housing market about the demand side. And you listen to some of the home builders out of the reported earnings, like KB Homes this week or Lennar, you know, they'll tell you that the demand side is still very strong. And I think in some parts of the market, maybe it is, but I think there's no question that consumers have gotten sticker shock between high prices and now rising mortgage rates. And the only reason why demand may be strong is because they just want to buy a home to take advantage of rates where they are before they go higher. But once sort of that pent up, dense sitting jump off gets satiated, then I think we'll get to see what real demand is with rates where they are, where the 10-year mortgage rate in the U.S. has gone from 320, 330 a year ago to 4.5 as of yesterday.
Yeah, Peter, that's an interesting point on the real estate market, because as the rates start to rise, there is going to be that choke point where it'll crush demand. And what will usually happen in that environment is the prices of housing will come down as the rates are going higher, which kills some of the wealth effect. And so I was going to ask you about the wealth effect anyways. The markets have pulled back, the general equities, really since the end of last year. A lot of tech stocks are down in a big way. A lot of the general markets are still down on the year. So that wealth effect is waning as far as how people feel. And when you hit them on the other side with inflation and costs going up and almost everything from the gas pump to the grocery store, is there a point where some people may start getting a little more defensive. We've seen the precious metals do well, even in the face of the rate hikes. Do you think more people will start looking at defensive and safe haven plays in this kind of an environment?
Well, I think that that's for sure going on. I think everyone has got their antennas on for what is the extent of an economic slowdown globally. We know Europe is going to slow down in the face of this spike in food and energy prices and what's going on with the war and all the sanctions and all the disruptions that creates. China is, of course, slowing down. It's just a matter of to what extent at this point. And that is, I think, what is to come, as I said earlier, that will then in turn dictate where markets go and where rates go, and on top of the Fed trying to deal with, and all central banks trying to deal with, the spike in inflation.
Now, Peter, this ties into a just general conversation on U.S. equity markets and just how dependent they are on this free money. Because as investors started to finally listen to the Fed that they were going to be pulling back and that they were going to be raising rates, to me, it just makes sense that we are going to see weakness in the U.S. equity markets. And quite frankly, we have. Look at this year. It's been consecutive lower lows and lower highs. The fact of the matter is, when the punch bowl is pulled away, that money at best would just rotate into somewhere else. But can we, or do you expect at all, any sort of a bounce or even run back towards some of the all-time highs in U.S. equity markets anytime this year if this environment of easy money really is off the table for now?
I mean, I think it's highly unlikely. You know, if you break down, and I don't like making broad market calls, just because the futility of it being right. But if you break down what drives stock prices in the aggregate, it's earnings and the P multiple. You know, if I'm right that growth is going to slow this year, well, you have to believe that earnings estimates will start to slip. And with the rise in rates and tightening monetary policy, well, we've already seen a compression in the P multiple, and that will likely get furthered as we get deeper into the Fed shrinking their balance sheet. I mean, we're going to go from, just in a few months, the Fed adding $120 billion a month to their balance sheet to reducing it by $80 to $100 billion a month. And QE was purposely meant to lift stock prices, as Ben Bernanke told us in November 2010 when he wrote an editorial for the Washington Post. So you can't have the purpose of QE easing financial conditions and lifting stock prices and have QT not really have an impact.
That makes sense. And we've seen the markets pull back in tandem with that liquidity drying up. So the other thing would be a lot of newly minted traders that came on the scene in the last couple of years while they were locked down during the pandemic and started trading from home also just had some funds wiped out. So some of that money was just evaporated. So it's just not there to buy it back to the same nosebleed levels some of those PE ratios had got to. But one sector that has been moving is the commodity sector. So I'd love to get your thoughts on what we've seen in the commodities, not just since the Ukraine crisis started, but really since the beginning of the year, kind of ended last year, we've seen commodities on a run higher. What's your outlook on that space, Peter?
So, you know, I've been positive and long since September, October 2020. But I do have to admit right now, while I think the fundamentals are great and this could last, I'm just more uncertain. I think with respect to oil and gas, I still think prices go much higher, but we're already at, you know, 110 in WTI. So it's not as easy from here, even though I still expect prices to go higher. And I think oil stocks are still pricing in much lower commodity prices. Agriculture has done very well. I've been long the fertilizers up until recently, and that trade probably will continue to work out, but I've taken a break from it. Just more uncertain about what the potential demand destruction is with these spiking fertilizer prices and the lack of demand, unfortunately, out of Ukraine, since they're not going to be able to plant that much in this planting season. But the fundamentals are great. Obviously, still very positive on precious metals. I say obviously, but that's been my story for a while. And with respect to industrial metals, I still think that what's going on with the war has definitely caused even more of a constraint on supply. I'm just uncertain in the short term what the demand side is going to be like if global growth slows. So I think copper prices are going to probably go much higher in the next 2 to 3 to 5 years. Yes. But where it goes over the next 6 to 12 months in the context of slowing growth, I'm not sure.
Can we elaborate a little bit more on that when it comes to governments really needing to issue or move through some infrastructure plans. That can be a key driver for these base metals. But I think I see where you're coming from here, where if we do see some broadness across the board for economies, then base metals, industrial metals should struggle. Can governments help to save them a little bit in case we do get this, in a way, almost crash scenario?
Not really. I mean, if you look at the U.S. Infrastructure package, it's going to be spread out over 10 years. So the annual numbers being shelled out isn't just going to be that much of a needle mover. Now, of course, it will create incremental demand that wouldn't have happened otherwise. But I think in the context of the global demand for commodities, it won't have that much of an impact.
Peter, you brought up your affinity to the precious metals. Our audience is obviously also very into the precious metals and also some of the precious metals mining stocks. And what we hear, since you brought up the interest rate discussion at the beginning of this call, is that when rates are rising, that that's bad for gold because it doesn't pay a dividend and that everybody's going to be more interested in things with the yield. But we've also seen gold hold its own lately and even get very close to its all-time high again. So what's your outlook on gold and silver? And do you think they can still thrive in the precious metal sector, could still thrive in a rising rate environment?
I do. And we're seeing writ large how it works in a rising interest rate environment, as gold is not far from a record high and interest rates are at multi-year highs. And like I said earlier, we've seen a very sharp spike in a short period of time. So it's sort of proving its mettle, no pun intended, in this inflationary environment, that even with an aggressive Fed, inflation will still remain well above nominal interest rates. Therefore, real interest rates will still remain deeply negative. And you can throw in another bull case for gold, and that's how we've sanctioned Russia and we've sanctioned their central bank. And that at the end of the day now, no asset that has counterparty risk is really safe anymore. But if you're a central bank and has gold reserves in a vault underneath your feet, well, there's no counterparty risk and there's no contra liability to that. And that's probably the safest reserve you can have. So I think that gold has taken on sort of new level of importance in this new world order, where no asset is truly safe from a government that may not like you.
Yeah, what a crazy realization this is right now for a lot of people. How do you view the underlying gold stocks then, Peter? Because the majors are making money, but there hasn't been this flood of cash broadly into the actual stocks underlying gold.
Well, you will witness typical retail mentality, and I'm sure institutions to an extent, that this money will come in only after they've had a big move. And I think that fundamentals, you can argue, have never been better in terms of how many of these gold companies run their business for more cash flow and not empire building. And with all-in sustainable costs being somewhat closer to 1,000 or even 11 to 1,200 with this recent uptick in raw material prices and labor and so on, and with gold, you know, hitting these highs, I think your profit margins are pretty wide and pretty attractive.
Well, Peter, I'd be interested to get your thoughts on silver, because it's a precious metal for 5,000 years. It's been money, but at the same time, it's got an industrial component, where it sometimes tracks the commodity sector. It's got that hybrid nature. So what's your outlook on the silver market?
So I've been bullish on silver as well. And obviously, it's been frustrating in that it's still well below its highs. I think the industrial component to silver adds some sexiness to it, and that it is a key raw material in this new renewable world that people want to shift to. Now, we know that said, silver still trades with pretty much where gold is. So it finally is getting some legs, and I'm rather excited about where it goes to the upside. I think that there's a tremendous amount of upside. And if you look at the entire commodity world, name me one outside of silver that's down 50% from its all-time high. I don't know of any.
That's a very good point. Why has silver lagged so much then? Because there has been this renewed interest in the sector, and I realize, you know what, higher prices brings in more investors, but again, silver has just broadly lagged when we've seen industrial metals and even gold move much higher.
I don't know. I, I, I,
I'm confident I understand why gold and silver underperformed in 2021 after a good 2020. I think that was the belief that either inflation was not, that what was transitory, which obviously was not, or, and if it wasn't, well, the Fed would raise interest rates and QE, and that would be negative for gold, even though the lesson was the exact opposite when they were raising rates in the late, in the 70s and mid 2000s. And gold bottomed when they started raising rates in December 2015. But now I think that the bull market's resumed, and I think that silver has a lot of catch up. But you know, outside of last year's performance, that's my only explanation for why it's underperformed. You know, looking out over the past 12 plus months, actually the underperformance really started in August of 2020 when it peaked after that big move.
Yeah, we're closing in on 2 years.
Right, and then it had another attempt at a run when people thought it would be a meme stock. But that was really just a one-day response.
Yes, the silver squeeze in February of 2021. So yeah, it was almost over before it began. Mm-hmm. And it did mark a top for quite some time. Well, there's one other area that's been quite volatile, and I guess you could consider it a currency or a option outside of the fiat system, and that's the crypto markets. We hear a lot of noise about it in the markets, both bullish and bearish, and it's been a very volatile sector since its inception 13 years ago. But we have seen big moves in Bitcoin and Ethereum, followed by big crashes as the inflation got hotter, and then a recent spike back up. Do you have any thoughts on the crypto markets?
I get asked the question a lot, and I don't know yet, at least right now. I think that I have a lot of commonality with the bulls of Bitcoin in terms of its creation and its intended function of being a store of value. It's obviously not a medium of exchange, as long as it can be taxed. But from a store value standpoint, when you think about the 13 years of Bitcoin, the only thing it really knows is zero rates, negative rates, and massive QE, you know, outside of bouts of trying to reverse that. But so it's essentially only known easy money. So it's now being tested to a notable extent with much higher inflation and higher interest rates. And it's more acting like a tech stock than acting like gold. So I still think that from that sort of intended use of Bitcoin, it still needs to prove itself, and it hasn't yet. I still respect it. I watch it. Maybe I'll be long it one day, but for the purpose of wanting something, a hard asset that is not a fiat currency, that doesn't have counterparty risk, and is a good thing to hold in times of negative real interest rates and high inflation, I still would prefer to own a gold or silver coin in my hand than something on the computer. Again, I still think that there's enormous amount of optimism to be had for crypto and the whole build out of the DeFi industry. But I'm just really talking about, you know, in terms of the price of Bitcoin and whether it's serving its intended function or not, as opposed to just, like I said, following tech stocks or even, you know, the ARK ETF.
It's a very good point, Peter, that really cryptos have only known easy money markets and easy money policies. I guess we can wrap it up then with, how do you compare what we're going through just this year, 2022, in terms of all the data, all the tightening that we are starting to see, everything we've outlined in these first couple of segments here? How does it relate to any other time in history? What kind of analog are you using right now?
So I am a student of history. And I know we try to find previous moments that mimic this. But, you know, zero rates, negative rates, and all this QE to this extent was always somewhat new. I mean, never in 4,000 years of history did we see negative interest rates. So I'm not sure how analogous this time period is to previous times. You know, you can say, okay, the 70s, high inflation, this is similar. Yeah, from an inflationary standpoint, yes. But debt levels globally were much lower then. The global economy, the U.S. economy, was better able to handle very high double-digit interest rates. Well, that doesn't exist anymore. So there are similarities in some aspects, but a lot of uniqueness to others.
All right, Peter, we're going to leave it there. Really appreciate you spending these first three segments with us. Thank you again for your time. I love reading over all of your emails and everything you post on the Book Report website. We're going to have you back on probably in another month just to recap kind of where we stand. But already, boy, oh boy, this year, very, very different than any year over the last decade plus. And now we're all just trying to figure out where we go from here. And the Fed is trying to do the exact same thing. Peter, thank you again for your time. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Thanks, guys. You too.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout.
All right, welcome back here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. I hope everybody enjoyed those first three segments with Peter Buchvar. Boy, we covered a lot, and I think everyone can understand just the different world that we are in this year with how markets are reacting and what central banks are doing as well. And that's even outside of this ongoing war in Ukraine. We are wrapping up the show with Craig Hemke, founder and editor of tfmetalsreport.com. Craig, let's just get your broad assessment here. I mentioned on the onset of this show and the day when I dropped in back on Thursday of this week that taking a kind of more broad look at the gold sector, seems like everything is lining up positively. And I'm not one to say that very often, but gold stabilized above 1900. The majors are doing well. There is this general rotation of money into some of the safer assets, and gold is finally being viewed as one of those. What's your outlook here for gold? Is, again, holding strongly above 1900 and finally some money flowing into the bigger stocks, at least.
Oh my gosh, Corey, I'm gonna have to put you on hold while I sell everything.
I know. It's scary. I'm not used to feeling this way, Craig.
No, I have to make sure I listen to Peter Buchvar as well. I've gotten to know him over the last year or so. He's a very sharp guy, so I'm sure he had all kinds of good insights. And there's a lot going on. The gold looks good from a number of reasons, for a lot of the reasons we've been discussing for years. Silver's picking up. There are commodity shortages that have developed over the last several months that are now being exacerbated by the Russian-Ukraine situation. Inflation is raging and only going to get worse. Hard to see how a 25 basis point Fed funds rate hike from 0 to 25 basis points is going to get it under control. The bond market, though it has been selling off and longer rates have been moving up, the bond market is starting to point toward what we call a policy error by the Fed, is that the Fed's going to start hiking just in time to send us into some kind of stagflationary recession. On Thursday, this was noteworthy. We noticed on, at least as the futures contracts go, in the silver market, we got what's called a bullish cross, where a shorter term moving average, is a 50-day moving average, moved up through the 200-day. Without getting, you know, the technical analysis of that, that's certainly something, though, that a lot of traders and trading machines are programmed to notice. And Thursday saw a big move up in silver as well. The shares look pretty good. The only downside to all of this is in all the years that I've been watching the precious metals, usually when things look pretty good, that's the time you got to sell some. You get that kind of counterintuitive component. However, big picture, a lot of the stuff we've been discussing for years, Corey, is starting to play out.
Well, Craig, it's interesting that you brought up the Golden Cross and silver, because silver has finally started playing a little catch up to gold. It's outperformed gold a number of days over the last few weeks, but it still hasn't broken out anywhere close to its all-time high like gold is getting closer to doing, and gold just did 2 years ago. So it's been a little bit of a laggard, but when you see those shorter term moving averages moving up to the longer ones, it just means that momentum is picking up in the shorter term, and so is pricing. And we saw that exact same thing in GDX and GDXJ. So I'm glad you brought it up, because we've seen golden crosses around the board. And when you see the miners outperforming the metals, both the silver miners outperforming silver and the gold miners outperforming gold, and silver starting to outperform gold, that's usually getting things lined up in the right batting order for a more bullish move. Do you think this could have some legs to it, or is it time to start selling?
Yeah, that's the important thing for people that are listening to us and have not been taking positions or are just starting to look at the metals and the miners for the first time. These, what we call bullish crosses, as you said, Shad, are a sign that they don't usually happen at the end of a move. Let's put it that way, where you might get what we call negative crosses or death crosses instead. So we're probably in the early stages of this. You know, I really thought that this year would unfold in this manner, but more gradually. But of course, you know, I wasn't anticipating all of the stuff regarding Russia and Ukraine either. So we're headed in the direction I thought we'd go this year. It's just happening a little quicker. And the precious metals in all their forms look pretty attractive. And again, we're seeing such a challenging time in the commodity markets in that, you know, even before the Russia-Ukraine crisis flared up, there were signs of significant shortages of metal in the primary metal markets of London. And if I don't know how closely people have followed this over the last couple of weeks, but the nickel market in particular has had some extraordinary events taking place in it. And even as the week wrapped up, it was back to moving up the limit every day in London. It's not just nickel, though. It's zinc, aluminum, copper also is in tight supply in London. And you wonder how much that can spill over into silver, too. So there's just a lot going on. And the last thing I would add is the maybe with some of the news, it was a little bit under the radar here last week. This, I think it's hit maybe Wednesday or Thursday of last week, was this news that Russia said, which you could probably have seen this coming, said, we consider you an unfriendly nation, we will only accept payment for our natural gas and our other natural resources in rubles. But then they further went on to say, and this at least didn't get a whole lot of press at the time, they said they also accept gold. And so that's one of those noteworthy little signposts that people might want to make sure they noticed as well. It's a very, very interesting time to be in the precious metals. And I'd encourage all of your listeners to start paying close attention.
So, Craig, as precious metals focused, look, we all hear these comments of a crash or even a great reset, taking it a step further where it's a very different financial world than we currently have. How do you balance those two out? Because I do see the potential for a market crash, even correction here. Markets are due for one. The whole great reset thing can almost be used by some as more a marketing ploy than anything. But hey, if it does happen, wow, what a different world we could be in. How do you balance those two narratives?
Well, you know, it's something that's always been on our minds, right? You know, the current fiat currency system, you know, with the dollar as its anchor, has been getting more wobbly by the year. And, you know, history is replete with examples of, you know, you kind of hand that baton from one reserve currency to another. You know, I'd watch more closely maybe this in the interim, and that'd be the U.S. bond market. You know, it was just 3 weeks ago this weekend that the U.S. and the EU, all of the NATO countries, decided to cut Russia off from the SWIFT system of international payments. At the same time, they also froze about $300 billion of Russian assets, foreign currency reserves that were held outside of Russia. Okay, if you're the U.S. and Great Britain and the like, okay, that doesn't seem to impact you very greatly. But boy, everybody else around the world that owns foreign currency reserves in dollars or dollar equivalents like treasuries had to sit up and take notice. It's like, wait a second. If we don't play ball with what you want us to do, you've just shown us now your hand that you'll cut us off. Well, curiously, in the time since, the yield on the 10-year note has gone pretty much straight up. It was 1.74% on Friday, March the 4th, before that weekend. This week, it got as high as 2.4%. I mean, that's a huge move on a percentage basis in 3 weeks. And rates go up as people sell their bonds. You know, there's all this thought out there that, you know, to preclude a market crash, if interest rates get too high like they did in late 2018 and Chairman Powell steps in and starts adding liquidity to preclude a market crash and, you know, create, you know, to try to stop everything from getting away from him. Well, what if he can't stop it this time? And what if rates, you know, instead of stopping at 3%, go to 4 or 5? I mean, that's got to be factored in as well. How would that impact the stock market? How would that impact future quantitative easing programs? This is a, like I said, this is a very, very interesting time to be monitoring the markets and trying to make sense of it all. It's not easy.
Yeah, Craig, they may not be able to put Humpty Dumpty back together again after this one, and it'll be interesting to see them try. But you brought up two good points there. One was really the bond bubble maybe had bursted in 2020 when we saw those really low rates, and ever since then, there's been a steady increase in rates. But there's also only a 20 bip spread between the 2 and the 10-year treasury. So there's a really flattened yield curve in this environment. And if it inverts, that's also the signal that there could be tougher times in the economy. So that would tie into the whole recessionary idea and possibly the market pullback. But on the Great Reset side, kicking Russia off the SWIFT system is a totally different animal, because if you're China and you're watching, if you're India and you're watching, if you're Brazil, you're seeing this happen. And there's already plans for those nations to start working together to maybe come up with a different system. There's already something that's been signed by 100 countries called Project Sandman, initiated by Saudi Arabia, where there's 100 countries willing to try a different system. And then we have these high oil prices and OPEC not wanting to play the petrodollar. So wouldn't you say that the Great Reset concept is really about a new reserve currency and a new global alignment of money, a new Bretton Woods, if you will? And really the recessionary fear is more of a U.S. phenomenon that could hit the markets here.
I'd say you're right on both points, Chad. As you mentioned, the yield curve, there are instruments that trade that actually have 1 year forward projection of where interest rates will be. And that's already showing an inverted yield curve for next year this time, meaning that short-term rates are higher than medium and long-term rates. And that is almost always a precursor of recession. That's probably all part of why the general stock market is holding up, because the stock market's already looking past all of this tightening and assuming that the Fed is just going to turn around and start cutting again and adding liquidity. I mean, talk about front running. I mean, we're talking, they're front running events that might take place a year from now. Getting back though to the major kind of epical changes that we're talking about here, you know, the line I've often used, you know, comes from Lenin, which is, you know, sometimes decades worth of change happens in a couple of weeks. And it's pretty likely that we are in that type of situation now. Saudi Arabia said just last week that they're going to start selling crude oil in yuan, Chinese yuan. Not that maybe the U.S. will become, won't just simply become the, you know, longer the reserve currency. There'll just be other currencies that'll be trusted to be transacted in. And the U.S. dollar will still be important, but just not the sole reserve currency anymore. And for, as for the implications of that, for everybody listening, let me put it in just Econ 101 terms. It's just a function of supply and demand. I mean, we have been supplying dollars unfettered, unbacked by anything for 50 years. And now we have $30 trillion of an accumulated deficit in the U.S. Well, those dollars, there's been demand for those dollars. Therefore, inflation hasn't been out of control. It's been everybody else's problem. Well, if all of a sudden you start cutting into the demand for dollars by offering other currencies you can transact in, or by company or countries selling their products like oil in something other than dollars, well, all of a sudden you have considerably less demand at a time when supply continues to rise, you know, a couple $1 trillion a year in new debt. So that you, again, think of any product, you know, I think maybe we might've talked about this a couple weeks ago in these terms. Think of oranges. You know, if there's a bumper crop of oranges 1 year, at the same time it's decided that orange juice is a carcinogen, you're gonna have a massive supply and falling demand. And that's what will take place in this reset idea with the dollar. You're going to have ongoing massive supply, but falling demand. That produces a lower value every time. And as the value of the dollar falls, this inflation, your standard, your cost of living and standard of living and everything else just continues to worsen. And that, unfortunately, is the path that we're headed down.
Boy, oh boy, let's see if these rate hikes do anything to slow that inflation. Just a quick comment regarding the gold stocks then, Craig. Majors have done well. The juniors still, though, have broadly lagged. Still a couple juniors that have done well. I know you follow top to bottom a lot of stocks, large and small. What's your assessment? It's still that lagging nature, and not only the juniors, actually, also a lot of mid-tiers and development companies.
Yeah, this can be very frustrating if you're kind of not real familiar with the sector or how it works. But this is exactly how it always works, because so few individuals, retail investors, institutional investors and the like, have any exposure to gold at all. I mean, the global asset allocation to precious metals and mining shares and equivalents is like less than 1%, like 0.5% global asset allocation. Nobody even pays attention to it. And so typically when gold and silver start to go into favor, think of it as like this. You call up your stockbroker and say, hey, gold's going up. I want some exposure. Buy me a gold mine. Well, maybe they might buy you some ETF, or they'll, the stockbroker whose firm does all their research for them, he doesn't know anything about any gold miners. And so maybe he goes to the ETF holdings page and sees that Newmont is the number one holding and says, it looks at the chart, sees it's going up, says, okay, we'll buy you some Newmont. And so the large companies, which are more easily understood, followed, there might be some research notes on it, they get bought first because that's the easiest thing to do. Then as the bull market continues, that's when people start to dig a little bit deeper and they recognize they get a little more leverage out of a junior producer or some company that's just about ready to go into production or something like that. Then all of a sudden, those shares start to go up as referenced maybe by the GDXJ. And then when things really get exciting, and some would say frothy, or you're getting into the eighth or ninth inning of everything, that's when everybody's like, oh yeah, look, at this price, these ounces in the ground become economical and this exploration company is really going to take off. And that's when you get, the penny stocks, a lot of companies that are under a dollar start to really pick up. So it's a normal part of the cycle. It shouldn't be anything that frustrates anybody. In fact, it should be a good sign that we are still in those early innings, as we discussed, right, as we began this conversation.
It is still crazy to see just how little value ounces in the ground are garnering. Doesn't even matter what country you're in. So, yeah, to your point there, Craig, we definitely haven't gotten to that stage in this game, or I guess you could call it bull market. Craig, we're going to wrap it up here. Great chatting with you. Thanks for taking the final segment of this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend. Everybody else, thank you for tuning in to this weekend's edition. And make sure you go back throughout that week and listen to all the interviews Shad posted throughout this week on our website, kereport.com, or podcast, Corlin Economics Report. Craig, everyone else, thanks again for your time. I hope you all have a great weekend.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.